Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 21st, 2001. In the fireside room this afternoon is Dorothy Bass. Today's session number is BAD 2001-4, and it's titled Consumed by Consuming. Let's listen in.
Bass, welcome. I'm teaching 5 sessions this week, but the one yesterday and the one today kind of go together in my own mind as a pair, because both are focused on, drawn from my reflections on a wonderful book that I encountered this year by a Catholic theologian named Richard Gagliardi. I've written it up there, called Transforming Our Days, Spirituality, Community, and Liturgy in a Technological Culture. And this will be providing the kind of the grist, the ideas for what we'll be talking about, but I hope we can also get to a point of thinking about how we can take some of the ideas that I find so fruitful here home into our lives as human beings who live in a very technological culture, where I think there are many, many forces that see us chiefly as consumers. You know, not as human beings even. I mean, there's one small portion of our humanness that is consuming. And I think there are many forces that are seeking to really define us and other people in that way. And that if we're to live if we're to understand who God has meant us to be, and to live into the promises that were made for us and that we have reaffirmed in baptism, then I think we need to look at and resist this cultural effort to interpret all of life as one big party of consumerism. Gagliardi, by the way, draws on the work of a philosopher by the name of Albert Borgmann. You'll hear his name mentioned. His work is much more technical than Gagliardi. Gagliardi's service has been to take the philosophy of technology that Albert Borgmann developed over the years and bring it into a very down-to-earth Christian application. So that's what we'll be sharing. But in a different way, if you weren't here yesterday, I think you'll be okay. I'll make sure and make things clear. If you were here, we won't really be repeating very much, so it should work. Both of these thinkers propose that because of the technology that surrounds us, we have come to, as they say, take up with the world in a certain kind of way. That modern technology is a way of taking up with the world, which is really different from pre-modern technology. Now, people have been using, you know, making things, making shovels and axes and doing what we would call technology, you know, enhancing our ability to transform nature for many, many centuries. But there's something about modern technology that is different. Let me get to that in a moment, and add this about the consumer focus. At Holden over the years, we've often talked about consumerism and been aware of the way in which the economic life of which we're part in the larger culture opens up issues of justice and injustice to us. One of the themes of Holden has been live simply that others may simply live. But these thinkers are proposing that we need to understand the whole way in which we're enmeshed in consumerism in order to get to the point where we can even begin to liberate ourselves from that. Part of what it means to be a consumer today, I think, and these thinkers would propose, is to be able to consume the highest possible quality with the least possible trouble to ourselves. Does this make sense? Mm-hmm. The highest possible quality with the least possible trouble to ourselves. And let's start with a case study here that may draw us into this. right? A thought experiment. Imagine a professional woman who lives in Western Montana, who loves the outdoors, and has a set of treasured trails that she regularly runs. She's offered a lucrative position in the Midwest. Knowing that she loves to run outdoors, her prospective employer sweetened the deal by offering her a membership in a special health club that features treadmills with videotapes for runners to watch while jogging. Now, admittedly, this artificial environment would be a poor facsimile of the real thing. Okay? A glance in either direction would reveal other health club members, not wilderness, and the smells and sounds would be those of the gym, not nature. But what if modern technology allowed us to greatly improve the facsimile? You know those goggles they're making? Hyperreality, virtual reality? It's right around the corner, right? It's probably possible already. What if we could use a state-of-the-art projection screen, add temperature control blowers, and the appropriate sounds and scents? Now the professional might find this enhanced hyperreal encounter truly captivating, a novelty to share with friends. Borgman writes, consider this case. The professional woman, after a most stressful morning, is running in her favorite winter landscape. New snow is sparkling in the sun, yet the footing is perfect. Snow geese are vigorously rising from the river. Then it is quiet, but for the scolding of the Steller's jays. A snowshoe hare up ahead is hopping along the trail. There, suddenly, is a crashing in the brush, a gigantic leaping and pouncing. A mountain lion has taken the hare and is loping back up the slope. Quiet once more settles on the valley. A herd of elk is browsing in the distance. The trail is rising. The runner is extending herself. She reaches the crest of the incline. Another quarter mile and the trailhead comes into view. There's the experience. Borgman asks if it really matters whether this run took place in the real setting or in a hyper-real facsimile. We might be tempted to dismiss the difference as long as the sensory experience was exactly reproduced, but this would be a mistake. Assume the woman is coming to the end of her run. She walks past the trailhead to the parking lot, gets in her car, and drives down the snowy valley to her office. She is elated. People spend years in the mountains without ever seeing a lion. To see one at the height of a hunt is a rare blessing. And she feels blessed also to live in a region wide and wild enough to support mountain lions, and on a continent hospitable enough for geese to nest in the north and winter in the south. She revels in the severity of the early winter that has driven the snow geese south from Canada and the elk down from the high country. The snow must already be 10 feet deep on the peaks and ridges. There will likely be a heavy runoff in the spring and strong river flows throughout the summer. This is where she wants to be. Now assume also that the woman is coming to the end of her run. The vista is dimming, the running surface is slowing down, the ceiling lights are coming on. She goes to the locker room, showers, changes, and steps into a muggy, hazy afternoon in the high-rise canyon of a big city. All that was true of the real run would now be false. The hyper-real run would have revealed nothing about her surroundings, would have bestowed no blessings on her, and would not have been an occasion for her to affirm her world. Those last points, this would have bestowed no blessings on her and would not have been an occasion for her to affirm her world. See the difference? Now, in the terms of this philosophy that I'm presenting, the real run in the real wilderness would be called a focal practice, a focus, something that she practices, something that she does that focuses her whole life, her place in the world, her physical well-being. This would be a better example if it had some other people in it, which we'll get to in a minute. Okay? But a focal practice is something that one does. It takes strenuous, it calls forth capacities, but also calls us into all kinds of engagement and relationship with the natural world, with the world. Okay? The example we used yesterday was a fireplace. Okay? You have to tend the fire, you have to know about wood, you have to have older people teach younger people how to make fires. It's a place where our human capacities all come together. Okay? The treadmill with the perfect hyper-real goggles and the experience of all the wind blowing and so on is a device. Okay? It is it's a mechanized thing that can, without requiring you to live in Montana in this case, right, can make some of the same stuff, make the hard pump and certain things available. Not the same level of engagement with reality. Let me back up a minute. The example yesterday is the best example. Fireplace, right? Mm-hmm. Those of you who were here, what happens around a fireplace? You have to go out of your house to get wood. You have to know about wood.
The heat's in one room.
The heat's all in one room. People gather around, they tell stories.
Right? It takes a community effort to get it going.
Right. Chores, rhythms of life, cold in the morning, gets warmer later on. Okay? Focal practice. Device.
Thermostat.
Central heating. You don't have to know anything. Turn it on. Heat comes out everywhere. And it is related to nature, isn't it? I mean, somewhere there's stuff is burning. The environment's getting impacted. But that's hidden. You never have to think about it.
Maintains your environment the way you want it.
Right. You can have it right now the way you want it. Okay, where you want it, when you want it. Okay? The difference, and the idea that focal practices, here's some new terms. And here the run is the better example. They bring us into contact with the eloquence of the world. Something eloquent in our human engagement with the reality that one perceives in the midst of focal practice. Whether it's the fire, eloquent. It speaks of blessing. It speaks of something that has some depth, real. And but also there's some friction involved in getting it. You have to live in a certain place. You have to do the work of hauling the wood. Mm-hmm. There's friction involved in it. The device, on the other hand, does not have any depth. It's just there. Okay? It just delivers the commodity with no engagement on the part of the person with the stuff that's burning to keep us warm or with the landscape through which we might run. Okay? Is it making some sense? How many of you were here yesterday? Just a few. I probably should have started this a different way. These authors want to argue that in using device after device to get what we want, when we want it, with very little trouble to ourselves, okay, we are missing all kinds of opportunities for deep engagement with other people, okay, with the natural world. We are beginning to think that we can master time. Okay? We can just plain master time. Okay? In the process, our human capacities are diminished. To get good music, all you have to do is know how to use the CD player. Our capacities are to be musical people who can bring music into being are diminished. Who we are becomes less. Makes some sense? John, yeah.
Could you work that same thing with the ongoing controversy at our house about trying to help my son transfer his tremendous ability with his Game Boy onto, and his stick-to-itiveness and his perseverance and the challenge, to try to generalize that to his piano practice?
A piano is a focal thing which you deal with and you become part of focal practice. But it takes friction, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. You don't become good at it right now. It takes mentoring. It takes time. Right? And yet, it has such greater depth, doesn't it? I mean, the depth of human capacity and engagement that can happen is so much deeper than with the Game Boy. There's going to be some friction along the way. Right? He has to deal with other people to learn it. That's always a matter of friction. Okay? And there's some eloquence to a piano. I don't have a definition there, but just think of the eloquence to involvement with a piano that does not exist with involvement with a Game Boy. Okay? But why is a Game Boy so appealing? Okay? Why is it so appealing? And even when we show in almost any movie at Holden, why does everyone show up? Okay, what is it? Okay, these philosophers would say that we become sort of used to taking up with the world through devices. The friction and the time consumption of practice is too hard for us. It's getting harder and harder. We're living within the device paradigm, and we are become very intrigued by hyperreality, which has three features, if I can remember them. It is brilliant. It has lots of colors, and the screen is the best example. Okay, it's brilliant. It is rich. You get a good experience every time. You get a mountain lion. Every time you run, you get to see a mountain lion. Every time you run, it's the best weather in this thought experiment. Okay, every time. It's rich. Okay? And it's pliable. You can do it wherever you want. You can do it whenever you want. It doesn't limit you. You set the terms. It is pliable to your desires. My family just got back from Heart Lake a little while ago, and it was a lovely time, but we were sitting there, and it was almost time to come home, and my son said, "I wish we could teletransport back." Right? Yeah. I mean, we wish that. And the friction is hard sometimes. You know, running in the rain in Montana, in this example, it's not always as nice as it is here, right? Then, though, we got up to the place where you can look down the whole valley on the return trip, and there were the falls down below us. And I said to my daughter, "Wow, isn't this is so perfect, you'd think it was a movie." That hyper-reality sets the terms of what is real and good. And the Game Boy, the screen, pliable, rich, and brilliant, sets the terms. Okay? And you can get what you want when you want it. And being a consumer is kind of being someone who lives with this kind of expectation of life. What I'm kind of getting at. Yes.
I just really like those adjectives of brilliant and rich. Because when you started to say brilliant for device, I started to think of brilliant in the terms of intelligent or intellectual. And I would apply that more to something created by God than I would a device created by humans. And the parallel that makes to, it's a more of a long-lasting way to use your vocab, you know, the meaning that goes with the word.
Mm-hmm.
Like rich, mm-hmm. when you said rich, it's more of the experience you get it every time because possibly money can buy that.
Right, right.
But when you think about it in the creator's term of being rich,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it's forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's mm-hmm. it's that sort of, it's richer.
Right, right.
And it's more yes. brilliant.
That's right, that's right. Okay, so are you hearing this comment? And that God's reality is better than hyper-reality, right?
Yeah.
And this is very basic.
That's easy to say when I'm holding.
Yes, right. And it's uh-huh. this is a very basic Christian affirmation, right? That yeah. God's reality is richer than hyper-reality.
Mm-hmm.
That, and that indeed we can go into ordinary life, and Christians have through, I mean, you can read it in the Psalms, hear it in the mystics, that in the ordinary things of daily life, God's presence glimmers through.
Because nobody's right? going to be totally fed by devices. Nobody's going to ever be satisfied. Never.
Well, that's the question.
Never. Oh, it's, I don't think so.
Okay. Now, Borgman believes this very strongly. Very strongly. He will say, the thinness of life in the device paradigm, it's thin.
Mm-hmm.
It's thin. It won't satisfy. Mm-hmm. Give people the real stuff. And they will, you know, invite them into a practice and tell them it's going to be really hard for a while, but it's going to be so much better if you can, you know, live with the friction. If you can take the time, it's going to be so much better. You know, I think at the end of our hike, our kids would say that. But can we say that to the American people? And is it true? Throw this over. Is it? Do you all agree with your
Valerie
that the thinness of devices and hyper-reality does not satisfy? Game Boy does not finally satisfy Jordan. Yeah.
I have friends who are movieaholics, and it almost seems like sometimes like the more movies they see, the more movies they need to see.
Uh-huh.
And it's like that was good, but. That was good, but.
Mm-hmm.
So the thinness really comes through.
The thinness. Okay, yeah.
It strikes me that the Game Boy, though, does have eloquence, depth, and friction, though of an artificial nature. I mean, there's an eloquence to it in the sense that it has all the bleeps and the bloops going on. And the depth is you're going to different levels as you master different levels. The friction is the time it takes to master these different levels. But it seems. I mean, it's obviously pretty uh-huh. it's pretty artificial. I mean, you could turn it
uh-huh.
off,
uh-huh.
go back
uh-huh.
to it later when you feel like it, or if it's too hard, you quit,
mm-hmm.
or those kinds of things,
mm-hmm.
or look in the cheat sheet and figure out how to do it right.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it's very interesting. I've been really struggling with what the implications are of having been permissive with it. And it is amazing to watch someone who can put so much focus and energy into this device.
Mm-hmm.
And be tremendously competitive. But then if you transfer that competition to any other realm where there's other kinds of interaction, then it's deadly. Because if I can't win, I mean, I think you...
Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh. Well, I think that's what they would mean by rich here. It's rich, you can win, finally, if you keep doing it, right? But you can't necessarily, everybody can't with a piano, right? To some extent, yeah.
That devil's advocate a little here. How about, let's say that the Greek who played the lyre was confronted with the new reality of the piano, would he be saying the exact same thing that we're saying now? In other words, what I'm saying is maybe the device is also, if we want to look at it, created by God, and we ought to just go with the flow.
Go with the flow, okay.
I think that everything has good, and I think that children have to learn about the world, and they have to learn to survive in the world, and they have to learn about those things, but they also have to have the foundation of where it came from. So together, I think, yeah, it could be good.
You know, I first started thinking about this when I was asked to speak at a thing for youth ministers. And somehow, I just read this book, and I first of all applied it to young people, to teenagers.
and started thinking about how much they are targeted, terrible word, but it's true, as consumers, and how confused we are about what our human needs are and what our human wants are, and how that is manipulated. You agree? I mean, we don't know what human beings really need and what do we want. Mom, I need that shirt, right? I need that. Manipulated, and many do, I think, come to think of, to really think of themselves in terms of consumer goods, labels, and so on. I see some heads nodding. I have teenagers.
Well, I was struck by a PBS special on history, the early history of the automobile, on how Henry Ford creating the Model T was quite a sensation. Sales went crazy. People were dying to get these things. And then they noticed after, and I don't know the statistic, but after a number of years, that the sales went completely flat. And they weren't, people weren't buying. And so they sat down to figure out, how in the world can we generate sales? Because people were buying the car and they were satisfied with it because they all were working for a period of time. And then they decided, why don't we do this? Why don't we change them just a little bit every year? Give them a little more place of adding a different color or something. And then all of a sudden, sales went crazy again.
Right.
Because they, it was struck me that they created need. What we thought was, I need to have the latest Model T.
Right.
Not just the black standard version, which everybody had.
Okay, great. Yeah, and that's common. I think it's happened now in many kinds of commodities. Right. This creation of needs. All right, so if there are many forces trying to make young people consumers, and all of us, but I think there's a real focus on youth and drawing them into that. In fact, I read one marketer who said, we don't target youth, we own them. So there's that. I mean, is it possible that the thing that stands, that the resistance that one might develop to that world would be to engage young people really in practices, in focal practices that are rich, deep, eloquent, and that call forth their greater capacities? Okay? Could be sports, could be music, right? And could be liturgy, could be service. Okay, but to engage them in a level of embodied, real life with some friction might be the way to help them understand themselves and their capacities more fully. Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure where I'm going with this, but I guess I'm having some trouble delineating devices from practices, just because it seems to me that, as mentioned before, devices can become practices. The Game Boy can become that which has eloquence and depth and friction. I mean, at what point is the practice that's lost, you know, the practice originally is doing whatever it takes to come up with flour, growing wheat, or what, I don't know what one does. And that is the practice that's lost to the device of flour showing up on the doorstep. And then the practice becomes not the making of the flour, but the making cookies. And then that device, that practice is lost when the device of frozen cookies comes along. And then no longer, the device and the practice keep on shifting.
Yeah, they might. They
and
might
now the practice is just eating cookies and milk together, and I don't know if that'll be lost when I get a cookie pill.
Right. No, that's right. No, that's very good. And I don't think, I don't think there's a stable answer. I think you're right. It's historically contextual. Let's take the table, and that's something that everybody, we all eat, right? Let's say that the commodity that we're going for is nutrition. Okay, those calories we need keep us going, right? Start with a device, a microwave dinner, okay? There's a great cartoon in a recent New Yorker that shows a woman and a man standing by the freezer, and she's saying, what will it be, Thanksgiving dinner with all the trimmings, or Christmas dinner with plum pudding and so on? The device of the microwave dinner, you get all of the nutrition, right? But let's say it's also eaten in front of the television.
I think that great festive meals can come, in my experience, from frozen lasagna, you know, this kind of thing. But a meal without the people gathered at the table. Okay. Imagine households where the children going up there wouldn't know how to select a piece of produce as a good piece of produce. Okay, it's always frozen, it always just comes out. You wouldn't know a ripe tomato if you saw one. Okay. So there's a depth of engagement with the natural world. Okay. What is something that would be missing? Some other features of that would make a meal a focal practice or a device.
Other measuring together?
Right. Well, somewhat. If we're going to have, okay, let's say that I'm not saying much, being very clear here. The a family that has a rich table life. Okay. And you're thinking of festive meals, not every single meal, but festive meals. There is some knowledge of the foods themselves, holding the kitchen, right? What is a good tomato? What is not a good tomato? You know, how do you, where does this food come from? Is it fresh? Is it not fresh? How do you cut it? Right? Older people have to teach that to younger people. Right? There's some engagement that goes on in that. There might be a way of setting the table, right? Manners, a table prayer. A whole rhythm of life, a certain time that everybody's committed to be there to eat together. Right? There's a focus to life that is complex and multiple and rich. Okay? As opposed to, you know, choose your favorite food, stick it in the microwave, push the button, and eat it by yourself. Now, there might be many times when it's really good to do that. I'm not making a value judgment here. Okay? But there's a different engagement with the world. Is that, yes?
My 3-year-old grandson is used to, or gets a kick out of speed saying, "Come, Lord Jesus, be our guest," as the prayer.
Okay.
He came to our house and we sang the Johnny Appleseed song, "Kick of the Devil."
Yeah.
And now we sing that every meal.
Right. It is eloquence, right? And a level of engagement. And now a story that will be told over the years. Right? There's story attached to this meal. Right? So there's lots of things going on in the one hand, right? Whereas in the device, it's conceivable that lots of good relational things and engagements with the natural world would falter. Yes? Yeah.
For me, it's, and maybe I'm the top of Generation X here, so maybe maybe this is part of this coming through, but for me, it seems less about either focal practice or device, and more about, we have this technological age in which we're living. How do we use the devices to either promote the focal practice or to say no to them, and how do we use them critically?
Right.
So for me, it's about learning some hermeneutics or something to help us think critically. For example, in our church, the microwave oven has promoted the women of the kitchen being able to worship because they can now heat things up in a few minutes for coffee hour, so they aren't in the kitchen while worship is going on. So here's a device now that's being used in this setting, at least, in a way to promote the focal practice of having them involved. So I don't know what your response is, but that's the question that's going on for me.
Right.
Well, technology is just a tool. And the thing is, I think that if people discern, they won't worship technology.
Well, I think that is the common view. I think that's what's being challenged here. That there's something about living with certain kinds of tools all the time, like central heating, plus microwaves, plus, you know, to the point that you're disburdened, potentially. I mean, a well-to-do professional could potentially be disburdened. You could not have the burden of anything to do with food, entertainment, heat, housing, clothing, I mean, with childcare,
you know, all kinds of things, and could therefore be constantly in virtual communication with other stockbrokers all around the world. I mean, I'm exaggerating, you see, but potentially people, the well-to-do, could be disburdened of all kinds of things that people that have kind of been the stuff of human living, and be free from all of that. So it's a matter of, there's somebody back here who's wanted to say something.
Well, go ahead.
But when thinking about this situation of this rich person who has, I guess, lost their connections, the traditional connections to the world, but so what? Where's the so what? What are the larger implications that you're saying?
Okay.
In this situation.
The relation, his or her relationship to the natural world is completely cut off. Okay. Now he or she is making a constant impact on the natural world, but it's completely hidden from here. Okay, because it's all done by thermostats and and just very easy stuff, teletransporting ultimately.
Right. So,
and all kinds of engagements with people, real embodied people.
Right. So are you saying that, like, I don't know, they wouldn't understand because they could just turn the thermostat up instead of chopping wood? They wouldn't understand, like, when there are no more trees, there's no wood, they need for conservation. They wouldn't understand their impact on the environment.
That's one piece. Now, I'm going to also argue that it's okay to use central thermostats. But yes, but ultimately that's the logic of this kind of position. That you ultimately could be in like a little cocoon, never have to go out of your house, and order all the things that you need, and there you are. I mean, it's an extreme position, but it's coming.
It's not that far.
I mean, it's possible to stay in one's home, order stuff, and not be aware of the larger world in which one is in the back. Well, there's someone behind you who's been trying to get it for a long time.
Well, I think we've become a very service-dependent society, far removed from, like I say, the natural world. And many people, if they had to be self-sufficient, would be helpless, totally helpless, would have no idea what to do if these things fail. I think that we're raising a group of children who have no idea where their food comes from. They haven't got a clue. It comes from the grocery store. Have no idea that there's a thing called agriculture or any of that. I think that's really a dangerous place to be.
Yeah. Right. Yes.
I think the lady on the movie, if you saw the lunch date, she appealed to me to be the type of person. She was wealthy and elderly, and she maybe had been in a position like that most of her lifetime, that she really, when it came to problem solving, she never had to use those skills or, to deal with problems.
Yeah, but skills and human capacities to solve problems is part of what's at stake in these practices. Yeah.
I love two things in our house. One is the internet, because I can avoid Toys R Us. I can call up an area and get Legos, and then sit my six-year-old on my lap, and we can look at different Legos. I can say, you can have two, and that's it. He doesn't know I'm in Toy World, and there's all these things there. And then the other thing I like in our house is when the power goes out. Because that, I kind of look forward to those one or two times a year in Seattle when there's no power, because that makes the whole house slow down. Mm-hmm. We pull out the blankets, we look for the candles, we pull out the flashlights, you figure out what you can eat without power, and it's just a great reminder. And so I just think utility shutdown should be a part of every season, just for a short period of time.
Yeah, it's coming.
And your question, I think, is the one we need to really get to. But let me try a couple more ideas to help us get there, okay?
I believe, and these authors that I'm quoting believe, that not only could we not reverse technology completely, that we should not, that there are many, many ways in which the disburdenment, in which not having to, for everyone not having to haul wood and, have their own gardens and everything, not to mention transportation and medicine and, lots of wonderful things. But it's wonderful that much of technology has happened. However, if we begin to experience our lives, if we're so infatuated by hyper-reality, that we lose that sense of deep engagement with nature, if we're so so intrigued by pliability that we're not willing to go out of our way to be with other people, that we're not willing to accept the friction, let's say, of congregational life or of family life or whatever, that we are much, much poorer individuals. That we're really poor if we get to the point where we're not willing to accept friction of learning the piano or cooking a meal for friends and sitting down and actually making an appointment to all be there at the same time, even though it doesn't really fit anyone's schedule. Okay? That if we really fall for pliability, brilliance, and richness at every point, and that we feel the burdens in our lives, burdens of relationship and time are a problem, which is what the device paradigm is teaching us, then we will be much poorer as human beings. Okay, that's part of the pointer. Another part gets theological, that the mundane areas of life, we're going to disburden ourselves of all, let technology take over all the, because it's kind of the hard stuff, all of it. The mundane areas of life are devalued. We miss many opportunities to encounter God and one another in the ordinary relations of life, at table, in nature, and so on. And we miss many opportunities for that. And we also miss one of the key kind of aspects of the Christian way of life, which is the scandalous idea, I suppose, that it is in when we take on burdens that we find our way through to the richest and fullest life. When we limit ourselves, in a sense, to, say, one spouse, that with all the friction and burden that sometimes is, that fullness may lie beyond. Even that when we give ourselves to the tasks of caring for those who are vulnerable, that fullness can lie beyond, right? That even in our own suffering, sometimes there's a new life that comes as we understand our dependence on God and one another. Okay, so that a life totally caught up in hyper-reality, totally disburdened of the day-to-day friction, hard stuff, would be life both diminished as human life, but also life that is missing some of God in reality.
I get kind of cynical because to me, this is an oversimplification, but to me it seems like the same message is that we choose either God or the world. And I think that the world is so seductive that it really takes a lot of courage to resist that. And technology is so seductive. Oh, it's so neat. It does such neat things. And I don't know how you get that courage to resist that.
Okay, well, here, let me tell you his proposal. Okay, he's a Catholic man with four little kids. Right? And he says what we need to do is cultivate liturgy as a focal practice. Okay, don't let it go. Take the time. Do it in body. Okay, and let that liturgy reorient you to see God in the rest of the world.
and reorient you to understand that in the burdens of life, some of the joy also will come. So take liturgy very seriously. That's his first proposal. And it would have to be great liturgy, I think, and it would have to really be expressively tied into daily life, but I know liturgy like that. Okay? That's his first proposal. Second proposal is get yourself into communities. Do it in your family, do it in your churches, do it in your clubs, do it in your community orchestras, do it forever. Get yourself into communities and just hang on to and cultivate and enjoy two, three, four local practices. Okay? The things that take time and that have some friction to them and that that call forth your capacities more fully than a Game Boy does. And maybe you end up playing a Game Boy too, but if you're also in that great boys choir, you know, then maybe you'll be okay. Mm-hmm. Not just you, but your community. Obviously, if all kids and all communities were doing nothing but playing Game Boy, neither they nor the world would have much of a future. But that's what he said. Pick some, you know, and cultivate those. And then let the devices serve those. Use devices. We're in a technological culture. That's where we are. But you hang on to some focal practices so that you know who you are, you know your capacities. You're helping others to achieve their capacities. You're encountering the natural world. You're getting into some friction. You're taking on some burdens. And let the devices be helpful to that, but not ever the thing that you really are interested in themselves. Okay? Which might mean, you know, watching television, you know, for certain things that have to do with your deepest interests, but not letting it suck you in as the entertainment itself.
The consistency is what's tough, because you can do that now and then, but then to be consistent throughout your 24-hour day, that's tough.
I mean, yeah, I think these authors would say, and I agree, that technological society is very powerful, but find some places in life where you're just gonna dig in and say, we're not gonna let go of this. I mean, and I think that probably some of us do this, like, you know, frequent visits to Holden, which is a place of focal practices. Focal practices are just all over the place at Holden. You do things the hard way, right? by hand. You know, sort the garbage ourselves instead of just setting it out on the curb and so on. And maybe there's a rhythm of technological life, come to Holden, technological life. But I also think, when I read this book, I mean, I thought, okay, let's renew that effort to have our family dinners, right, and to get everybody cooking. Okay, let's support our school music program. So I'm wondering, I think I'm going to stop. We have time. I think that now your discernment, your question of, okay, the microwave is helpful in your church. So it's not that devices are bad. It's not that devices are bad. It's that if we let ourselves fall into that paradigm about everything, we're really in big trouble. Borgmann is most concerned about devices that create entertainment and that create experience. You know, yeah, which, you know, I suppose the bungee jump would be one of those. So, yes?
I think there's one other thing about the devices is that as our society becomes fuller of devices, we get the idea that there must be something to fit everything. And there isn't. So there isn't a device that helps us when we are lonely. There isn't a device that helps us when we are grieving.
Right.
So then the tendency is, what's wrong with me? I've listened to the meditation tape. I've been to see a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
And the device, all the device leads us to believe that there's something wrong with me when I can't find something to make it
right. Right. Yes. Thank you. I think that's a very important point. The life in the device paradigm tries to hide our limitations from us and the limitations of the devices. It tries to hide those. But our community of rich practices could receive and renew a grieving person in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Also, as a pastor, mm-hmm. one of the things that I've discovered is naming the things that hurt us frees people up to look at them and to know that they are not alone in grief or in aloneness. Mm-hmm. And I think that the church is the only place that ever happens. Mm-hmm. 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 And it's mm-hmm. much closer to focal practice than the device.
Yes.
Thing.
Now, there are some people concerned that some churches are kind of moving into the device paradigm. Okay, give us the religious experience really fast, really easy, right?
Yeah.
But a congregation that really understands that worship takes some time and the congregational life takes some time and it has some friction and we're going to hang in there anyway. No, that's a life-giving. That's a life-giving place. But, yes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm okay.
Yes, hi. Go
Here's
ahead.
Here's an example of that quandary for a congregation. Within a 10-day period in my congregation, we had a 14-year-old who was in a serious car accident that nearly took her life, and she was on the brink of death for about 2 weeks. Within just a few days of that, another 13-year-old in our congregation had a series of epileptic fits, which nearly took her life. And so for a period of about, I would say, 8 to 10 weeks, we had two young people in really serious condition. So one of the things the senior pastor at our church did was work with the both the email system and the voicemail system so that people could call up either way and find out an update on mm-hmm. each of these girls. Mm-hmm. And it was great for the prayer chain, it was great for the meals uh-huh. committee, uh-huh. it was great uh-huh. for, it worked right. really, really well. So there's an example right. of technology, you know, working in a very helpful way. Then as time went on, though, those situations, thanks be to God, stabilized and so forth. But then there began to be kind of both an expectation and a question of, well, is there a way we can call up and find out how everybody's doing?
Uh-huh.
You know, how do we, you know, how can we get that? Because then, of course, it became very difficult for us to keep that update going, because for mm-hmm. a while, when things were very critical, mm-hmm. we'd get on there and we'd make an update on the person and then we'd suggest a prayer or whatever. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that became enormously time-consuming for the staff, as well as it was an unrealistic way to think about the congregation working uh-huh. in general. But, I mean, right. you're getting my point.
Yes.
Here's an example
yes.
where the technology yeah. can be very useful.
Right.
But then how does it, or does one want it, to be part of the way the pastoral mm-hmm. care and information goes around? One of the other classes I was in talked about gossip as a useful thing.
Right.
In other words, that, oh, did you know that so-and-so, and you could really bring up. And that connection between those two is also a connection between mm-hmm. that one. So mm-hmm. there's a good case in point of how something can be very useful, and then you wonder, is this useful in the long run, and if so,
uh-huh.
how?
Uh-huh. And how did you do some discernment as a congregation about that?
We actually talked about it in a community mm-hmm. meeting and decided that in cases of that urgency, especially with, you know, the very young, you know, uh-huh. or where a real tragedy is going uh-huh. on, that we would use that system, but otherwise that we wouldn't, but that the pastoral care group would start an email trail for those who wanted it to, mm-hmm. to catch up with what was happening for people.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're using the technology in the congregation, but periodically it right. comes up for a decision uh-huh. is to, is this promoting our community life in Christ or is it not?
Right.
And my guess is we're not done with it.
Uh-huh. That's, well, and to discern, I think, is the main thing.
Yeah.
Do that discernment. and to think about that. Yeah, that's great. The tragedy would be if the use of the technology eroded the face-to-face,
right,
life of prayer and care that was in pretty good shape in the congregation. That would be the tragedy. Now, do you want to bring up your microwave thing? Do you really worry about the microwave? That sounds like a good use of technology to me.
I'm actually saying that's what I'm saying. Is that that's an example where in some situations a microwave could be a real problematic situation, mm-hmm. but in this situation, the microwave as a device itself is a good thing because it encourages the focal practice and enables people who otherwise felt the obligation to be the Marthas in the kitchen to now have some opportunity to worship. And that's why my question is really one of how do we use the devices and how do we come up with just some key questions to ask ourselves? And I know when I asked you about this yesterday, you know, you suggested that was a really great conversation to have within communities. And I would really like to see our faith community take that seriously and come up with some, well, what would be some key questions we could ask ourselves communally, but also individually? I'd like to think a little more about, well, in what ways is my home pilot really a good thing,
right.
and in what ways does it start to own me?
Right.
And what kinds of questions can we ask ourselves to discern that?
Right. Okay, let me try this question. I think it would be very good for each community or family or congregation to kind of say, what are the key face-to-face practices that hold blessing? You know, that even when they're hard, they're friction and burdensome, that there's something there that is really life-giving and where we experience both the presence of God and the willingness to be burdened ourselves, you know, for the sake of those practices.
A good test is turn off your favorite program as you're watching it.
Okay.
I've done it sometimes.
Just show
see whether you can do it.
Okay. Yeah. But in a congregation, you know, where worship, I think, ought to be one if it isn't. But what are the other practices that really are, we can't, you know, that ought not to be let go of and that even could be given some more time, some more space to grow? Because there is a sense that, you know, if we don't watch these practices, the rush of life, time, right, instant, you know, that people's unwillingness to give time will make it hard.
We've got a group of folks that have been struggling for a couple of years with how we can practically do good hospitality.
Mm-hmm.
And they've gotten to the point where we now know that if someone does come and visit, we can do cookies within 48 hours, and that will raise the percentages that they will probably come back. But if they don't develop 5 to 7 other connections with other people, they'll fall through the cracks. So people are starting to think about how do we make those other connections. And the notion of inviting strangers over for a meal or for dessert is kind of surfacing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we've been talking about it for a year, and now one person has done it once. Now these are skilled, competent people who have lots of friends and know how to, but the notion of inviting a stranger or someone that's moving in the community into your home, it scares the hell out of me. So I mean, I sort of see this little bit of, I mean, we're sort of trying to develop some focal practice around meeting new people.
How about resisting the temptation to hire childcare staff for Sunday morning and just keeping it as part of worship to equally participate in caring for our children?
To include children in worship as a focal practice.
Right. And to also consider your care of children during worship part of worship.
And how does your congregation go for this?
We're doing okay so far. Yeah, we've actually have struggled in the area of nursery care, and do pay someone from the congregation to make sure that it happens. We have a baby boom going on, but it's staying pretty, you know, good in terms of the shared teaching and involvement.
Other places, practices that you would consider cultivating that kind of keep us in that, keep you in, that form community and where burdens lead to life?
Yeah. I knew, relatively new in the parish program, and this congregation has built within itself wonderful ways of doing this. They present a cantata at Christmas, and people from the community are invited to come and sing with them. It is marvelous. The women quilt all winter long, and that is such a community building. It's wonderful to see. This small rural congregation does the Vacation Bible School in the summer. We had 55 kids last week, and everybody in the church helps. They donate food, or they help in the kitchen, or they help with crafts, or they work on the playground. And we have kids in the community, and this is probably the only chance they will have to hear about Jesus. But I'm learning so much from these wonderful congregations who have found ways to build those focal practices into their congregation life.
Thank you. Great. Yes?
I just wonder whether anyone has any experience of the projection systems during worship and how those have been received in different congregations as either devices or something that enriches the practice of worship.
We do that in our church, and it really enhances but our church is so much of very much of a live church, and bursting at the seams, and anything they can do to expedite getting things, for everybody on the same page, it works out very nicely for that.
Can you clarify the question, please?
I'm not at a congregation that has a projection system.
You mean like worship. PowerPoint or something?
Yeah, that kind of thing. And in what ways? For anyone who has that, in what ways is it enriching the focal practice of worship, and in what ways does it reduce in a device sort of way?
I think it helps visual learners too. Some people are more visual learning than they are auditory.
We can't get enough hymn books out to everybody, and whether we're having church or worship in the sanctuary, or whether we're having it in the dining hall or whatever we have. The PowerPoint presentation really helps because the songs are projected up there, the sermon is projected up there, the sermon notes, so on.
Do you find that anything is lost to the device categories? I mean, the brilliant, the rich,
I think a little bit of it is, but again, the logistics of trying to move all those books in and out and trying to get everybody up to speed, I think this outweighs that. You know, and they use it to the betterment of the community in this case.
I think that we should close, probably bring this to a close, but the discernment would proceed not so much by whether or not technology is being used, because it's inescapable, okay? But by sort of which mode of use, or which mode of being, which focus among the people involved is being enhanced, in this shared life of the community. I think that's where we would want to go with that, and that being alert to the importance of embodied interaction among people, even when it's a burden, as part of what it's going to take to keep worship going, to keep all kinds of wonderful practices going, is really what we need to keep our mind on. But thank you very much. Have a good afternoon.